And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Just a remarkable song, isn't it? It really cuts right to it. We're going to come back and take some final calls with Michael Goddard here on Coast to Coast AM in just a moment. And welcome back to Coast. Michael Goddard with us. His book is called, of course, In Search of Lost Lives. He's also got one called Spiritual Revolution, a seeker's guide to 52 powerful principles for your mind and soul. And let's go back to the calls. We'll go to Joe in Monterey, California. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure.
Dyslexia. Okay. it's nice meeting you, Michael. I know that it's very important to work with the sound current and the light. You need to work with both of them. I thought I was on the highest spiritual path until I woke up. I was meditating 3 or more hours a day, every day. That woke me up. Do you know what a silent one is? They woke me up. Okay. I was being attacked by black magicians in Ekankar, of which I was a member for over 10 years. Ekankar is a cult, but the work that you do on yourself with the sound and the light with the Shabda, because you will travel to those higher worlds. And the light is very important. You need to have a balance of both of them. So don't ever give up your spiritual practice.
That's very important. Yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Michael, since you've been on this mission to go through these past lives, have you come across the past life that you, other than the leader of that country that butchered a 250,000 people, would you have a past life that you weren't happy with?
Well, I mean, they all contributed to who I am. You know, that's an interesting question. It's sort of like they're all part of me. They're like children in a sense, but lives I wasn't happy with. Well, I mean, being a slave was no picnic, believe me. You know, and I did terrible things. Like one life, I had a food stall in India, and I got greedy and kind of gave away all our money to buy a goddess. It was a statue. So I deprived my children of further schooling. So that made me fall. I came back as an Indian bull. So all the lives were, you know, the balance was swayed in terms of the poor actions. I wasn't that happy with that. But, you know, each life, I mean, now, I mean, I live in Palm Springs, which is really warm. I had all these lives in Europe, pre-Christian lives and, you know, all the way through, I'm thinking, how did I keep warm? You know, that made me a little anxious, to tell you the truth. But I had a different system. So you kind of come in with what you need for that life to get through it.
Let's go to Joseph in Troy, New York now. Hi, Joseph.
Wow.
Go ahead.
First time on here.
Well, great.
Hello, everyone. This is kind of surreal.
Glad you got through.
I wanted to ask the guy about the past life thing. I just want to tell him, like, one time I was, like, cutting up something, like slicing up a package or something with a knife, but it felt like I was gutting a fish.
Okay.
I was, like, thinking I might have been, like, a fish cleaner in, like, a past life.
That's possible.
Oh, so is he asking whether he might have been a fish?
He might have been a fish cutter.
Oh, yes, quite. I mean,
I guess he could have been a fish, too, right? He could have been the one getting cut.
Right. I actually had an experience that just came naturally when I knew I relived a life as a duck, actually. It was by the palace.
You were a duck?
In San Francisco. Yes, as a duck. So I kind of had that flash of reliving that life. So I feel we've been everything, and probably including plants. I mean, I don't want to generalize, but probably most people have been through millions of lives. And the human life is really the top of creation because it's through this life in which you can really realize immortality and total love. So this life is really precious. Don't waste a moment of it.
Do you generally migrate to people in your other lives all the time? So let's say you had a group of 10 friends in a past life. Would you associate with their human bodies in this life?
You could, you know, it depends. I mean, there was one family when I was in Hungary where we'd had a number of lives together, and it was like a tremendously harmonious family. But one of the things that came out very, very soon was what I call my cohort of seven, and these were seven mind spirit entities I was mainly with between lives. We were like souls in training. So we were on comparable levels of spirituality. And these seven beings I've had the most incarnations with on Earth. And in fact, this life, we were all together. You know, we were all in America or England. And two lives ago, we were all here at the same time. So the experience was, when I first met them, it was like, wow, I was busy. All kinds of stuff was going on with my head. Part of me was trying to think, who is this person? I know this person. It was just hard to take in. Well, this is someone I've had all these associations with. So the group of people you may be with between lives is very key. And you may come back together as husband and wife, people in the same family, best friends. So that's very important.
Let's go to Brenda in Miamisburg, Ohio, first-time caller. Hi, Brenda. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you, George?
Okay. Thank you, Brenda.
Wonderful.
Thank you for taking my call.
Very welcome. Go ahead.
You somewhat alluded to the answer to my question already. How much of who we are, how much of our makeup, the things we enjoy, the things we have aversions to, the places we gravitate to, how much of that is from a past life?
Well, it would vary from individual, but for me at least, it's a great deal. You know, you also kind of come with your destiny karma. So if you had formed the desire to be a ballet dancer, you know, that would be an interest. It would be something you'd fulfill. But I think very much what is key is what you have affinities for when you're young, before your teens and even in your teens. I mean, in my book, I list all these questions I wanted to figure out, and it turns out they all relate to specific experiences in past lives. So I think discovering who you are is very much tied to, you know, who you've been in your past lives. I always had to strive to fulfill the Greek injunction, know thyself. And I think that's been one of the most happy things about this experience, is that I have a great sense of who I've been. And I didn't want to be distracted by all this once I left the material plane. I wanted to focus on my spiritual growth and not be brought back to what I was doing X number of lives ago. So I would say, you know, pay attention to your intuition, your feelings of deja vu, if you've had very powerful deja vu. All the deja vu I've had has a link specifically to past lives. So it's really a question of being aware and opening your sense of knowing.
We've got JD in Indianapolis with us now. Hello, JD.
Hey, Mr. Norrie, the good old lighthouse keeper. How are you?
I am keeping it shining.
Michael.
Yes.
How are you, Michael?
I'm just fine, JD. Good to talk with you.
My question has to do with synchronicities. I've been having a lot of them, and some of they're very interesting. They help keep me going, and some of them are really kind of weird, like someone's playing with me. I don't know what. But what is your opinion about synchronicities and how they have a connection with your past lives?
Well, you know, I would say, you know, synchronicities, it depends from where it comes. It might be your higher consciousness kind of creating a situation of a coincidence to make you pay attention and follow through. You know, you also have to be careful. It could be from a negative kind of power. So, again, you have to be, you know, on your toes, very alert to kind of suss out what kind of synchronicity is it. Is it benevolent, or is it not a benevolent one? But it's great that you have this awareness, and it's really, I think, a question of developing your sense of knowing of how and when to follow or appreciate that synchronicity. Often, you know, people will cross your path and it'll be really wonderful. It's meant to happen. So, you know, I would say hope for the best in your spiritual progress. And, you know, it could be any number of things. It's just, you know, we kind of, in this lifetime, we only have really limited awareness. So much is going on behind the scenes. And I think that's part of the adventure of this life is making the unseen seen. What is most real is what we don't see, really. And, you know, everything we see in front of us is not going to last. It's going to deteriorate. So I think it's really exciting that you're aware of all these synchronicities and you're honoring them. I would just say be careful and use your best sense of knowing as to, you know, whether it's benevolent or not.
Michael, what about birthmarks in past lives? Do they kind of carry over into the other life?
You mean actual physical birthmarks?
Yes, yes.
They could. I mean, if it's like connected with a karma. I uncovered a number of things. Like I was, you know, in each life I kind of give a basic physical description. And like, you know, I found like I had a big scar on my face in one life. And I found out exactly how that happened. But it didn't carry over, so they could. It's just hard to say. It's just one issue I didn't really come up that much for me.
Let's go to Miami. Joel's with us now. Hi, Joel. Go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great. Thanks, Joel.
All right, I have a question for your guest. You said that in some past lives you were a slave.
Yeah.
This whole system seems like everyone is a slave, okay? That's just the first comment I wanted to make. George, I have like a couple of questions real quick.
Yeah.
I can, okay. So how does God or the creator of this system expect a thinking human to be able to mentally deal with the idea of everlasting incarnations into animals, different places, far away, all that type of stuff? It seems stressful and, you know, a little bit could make someone anxious to be able to think of that for an eternity. The other thing is there a fixed number of beings that alternate between these incarnations, according to you, or can a new incarnation be created, like a new soul, a new consciousness, or are they all the same, just switching yeah. back and forth to different things? And the last thing would be blood. Why are there O negative blood types on the earth? Would you know that answer? They have no connection to the rhesus monkey gene. Actually no connection to evolution on Earth. And if you had that answer, that would be great.
Well, okay. Well, there's a number of questions. Well, first, I think your comment about everyone's slave is really quite apt. We're a slave to our minds, which are pulled every which way by your senses. So the whole idea of liberation is to become free and reclaim your free will and not be a slave to your karmas in the mind, wherever it wants to go. Now, in terms of everlasting incarnations, I agree with you. It would make me very anxious. I mean, that's why at a very young age, I wanted to devote my life to discovering a way to achieve immortality. But I am of the belief, and I believe this is true, that if you're marked to return to what I call the love source or God, you're going to return. So, I mean, most people, I think, just want to keep on coming back. They're not really aware of the suffering they've undergone. All they want to think about are the pleasures. So if you're anxious about it, it may mean that you're being pulled back to your true home. As to your question as to new souls, I think I will fully understand this when and if I rejoin the ultimate source, but I don't think new souls are created. People, souls and minds may come down that haven't been here for a while. If you've been hanging out in a heaven for the equivalent of thousands and thousands of years, it may seem like a new soul is coming in, but you're just returning probably to the physical plane.
And it's the blood O negative? It is rare. It's not the rarest, but it is rare.
Yes. That I really could answer. I haven't looked into the blood types except for eating according to your blood type, which I try to follow. I'm an A blood type, which I'm a natural vegetarian.
All right, let's take another call. Annie in Alabama. Hello, Annie.
Yes, I would like to ask you a question. Phone adjusted. You say your intestine died. Is that correct?
Yep, Your intestine died on you, didn't it?
Oh, yes, it did, and it explained a lot of the agony I'd gone through for decades. It's a miracle I was saved, actually.
Well, what saved you?
Well, they did. I was unconscious for 2 days.
Unconscious?
Yes, it was a miracle I got to urgent care.
Did somebody find you?
Well, I had been vomiting it up for like 9 hours.
Oh, God.
And all of a sudden I realized this is hugely serious, and I didn't have time to call 911 or call a neighbor, and I just got my wallet, got in my car, and I was driving. I was literally losing my consciousness. Somehow I got my car parked. It was very close, the urgent care. I walked in there. They asked for my ID. I took out my wallet. 2 days later, I woke up, and the nurse said, "Do you know you've just had surgery?" And I said, "No." And they did exploratory surgery and found that 7 feet of my intestine had died. And I had what's called, you could call, a complete attack, like a heart attack of the intestine.
Was it like as bad as colitis?
Oh, it was, yeah, completely different. it had been, the scar tissue from my appendectomy when I was 13 had been advancing for years and years and gradually killing my intestine. And that's why if I would eat when I was tired or I had cold liquid, hours later I would just start vomiting, and I'd vomit for hours and hours and get bloated. So it was a very, very difficult period. I'm still haven't actually recovered. I was a bodybuilder, and I lost basically 40 pounds of muscle mass.
That's crazy. How old are you, Michael?
I am just turned 69.
All right. Well, you still got many miles to go, as they
yes,
say.
Yes, I feel I'll be living to be 85.
Favorite part of your book, what is it?
Favorite part of my book? Well, there's some lives that I love. I love my Greek philosopher life. I live a life when I was a monk in Slovenia. That explains a lot.
A monk?
And I found, George, I actually found my monastery, and as soon as I found it online, I thought, wow, there it is.
Did you remember it?
Yeah, I did. And that was a very important life. It was 6 lives back.
That's pretty dramatic indeed. Well, Michael, we've got your website linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and the name of the book, In Search of Lost Lives. Up next, Richard Dolan joins us as we talk about government disclosure and UFOs. Well, Richard Serrett filling in for me tomorrow as I have some work with iHeart at the iHeart events coming up, and we're going to be bringing you some interesting things over the next several weeks as well. I'm looking forward to that. There are a number of UFO cases that stand out in history. Well, will disclosure ever get here? I had a chance to talk with ufologist Richard Dolan about special UFO cases and some of the obstacles we face about disclosure. So, Richard, this case that I stumbled off, I always knew about Frank Strangis when I was a kid. I would read his books, and a fascinating guy. But so I'm in Laughlin, Nevada. I'm at this event, and Craig Campobasso is there, and he's showing a film called Stranger at the Pentagon.
Right.
And it's a short film, and he's won an award for it from the Burbank Film Festival. But it was provocative. The story was unbelievable. It's based on Frank Strangis meeting this Venusian named Valiant Thor, who landed here and spoke with Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon when he was the vice president, and talked, stayed a couple years, and then he left. Weird.
Yeah, he left, I think, back in around 1960. I don't really know how to take this story, George. I will tell you that years ago, long before I did UFO research, I was friends here in Rochester when I was still doing graduate work at the University of Rochester, with, I believe it was a niece of Frank Strangis, who was living in Rochester with her husband, and she was taking a class that I was I think I was assistant teacher for, and I just became friendly. And she said, yeah, and my uncle is this guy, and she showed me his business card. It was Frank Strangis, and it seemed so strange to me at the time. I didn't take it seriously, and then years later I became familiar with his story. But actually, yeah, what he claims is that there is a Thor who, the normal-sized human, but lived like hundreds of years long. He had an extra digit on each hand. I think he had six fingers on each hand and other key differences, and could speak like every single language fluently, apparently. I just don't know what to make of the story. I mean, I have no idea. I would love to get back in touch with this lady who knew him and really interview her. I don't even know if I could find her.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an incredible case.
Our world. These stories make no sense, but then they just keep coming at us over and over again, you know?
And there's enough behind these stories to really be convincing.
Often that is the case, yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
in this instance, I don't really, I'm not comfortable saying one way or the other. And I really have been making a note to myself to see this film, and I haven't seen it, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, let's talk about some other issues here that you've been working on. You've talked about that it's harder and harder to determine if a UFO is made here on good old planet Earth by humans, or that it might be of extraterrestrial origin.
Yes.
Why is it so difficult these days?
Well, I mean, we, you know, if it were 1950, and we were to have a report of an object flying at an altitude of 100,000 feet at multiple thousands of miles per hour.
It's not ours.
That's
not,
right.
Not
in
them.
Fact, this was written about in Bruce Maccabee's excellent book that I published a little earlier called The FBI-CIA UFO Connection. And Bruce nails it, and he makes this case crystal clear that this was being tracked at that time back then in 1950, 51, in what was known as Project Twinkle. And people can look this up in his book. So that's one thing. That's 1950. And we know there's no evidence that we had anything that could go at that altitude, 100,000 feet, absolutely no way. Thousands of miles per hour, ditto. Today is a different story. We've got highly advanced drones. Now, there's this new story that's going on in France, which I know you've been following this, which is about these so-called drones that have been flying over French nuclear plants. And the last that I've checked, about almost two dozen of these, or excuse me, not two dozen, but like about 14, 15 of these, I think, have been noted, where these objects are hanging around French nuclear facilities. They are very sophisticated. And in fact, one of the more recent stories that I read just indicated that the French put army helicopters, which try to intercept these things, very advanced and efficient high-speed helicopters, and they failed. They tried to follow
them. That's amazing.
But they lost them. And then you have other accounts of these drones. They sound exactly like UFOs. They are, they've got like lights, triangular lights patterns described on them. Sometimes beams of lights coming down. I mean, all of this sounds very, very familiar to UFO researchers. Now, the media is describing these as drones, and you might just say, well, you know, maybe they're not drones. Maybe they're genuine UFOs. That could be the case. After all, there's a long history, very long history, of these objects being interested in hanging around in the vicinity of our nuclear facilities worldwide. Yes, all of that. However, it is also true that drone technology, especially the unofficial classified drones, more and more that we're starting to learn about these things are highly advanced. And, you know, I'll just tell you, and one of my witnesses, someone that I spoke to at great length, as a matter of fact, you know, described a drone sighting from 2003 that in New Mexico, that she was absolutely convinced, for a number of reasons, that this was one of ours. It was a spherical object, maybe 3 to 4 feet in diameter at nighttime, metallic, not perfectly smooth. It looked, she said, it was like a small version of the Death Star. And it was only 100 to 200 feet above her and her companion, who were in a hot tub having a nice evening in New Mexico. No noise, totally silent. Her opinion is that it was definitely one of ours, not an alien craft. I said, well, why do you say that? She said, I can't tell you exactly why, except that we were staying at the place at a ranch of a guy who was a high-level scientist, military contractor, who, when we mentioned this, gave this knowing look. This is back in 03. I've since learned, and in trying to understand the nature of drone technology and how advanced, that they are so advanced in terms of being able to make these objects that, you know, look like perfect triangular craft nowadays.
Right.
We didn't really have this capability a few years ago. So the line is getting very blurry. And by the way, that one individual, that woman, had an experience much earlier in her life as a teenager in the 1980s, where in her bedroom, she was just reading alone in her bedroom, and she looked up, and this object was a small, roundish object was hovering in her bedroom. And, I mean, it shocked her, of course. And she's just staring at it. She didn't see any motion. She didn't see it enter the room. This is in upstate New York at the time. It was about 1 foot across in diameter. It was spherical, metallic. There was a light on the front. Same type of light, she said, that was on this other object 20 years later that she saw. About the size of a basketball, hovering 10 feet away from her. She freaks out. She's thinking, what the heck is this? Her mother walks into the room, also sees it, and flips out. Now, the mom had not believed her daughter all these years that the daughter was having all of these strange experiences, on and on and on. Anyway, this object went toward the window, which was closed, and it went through the window without breaking it. Mom was hysterical, crying. What was that? So I had a long conversation with this woman about this. And this is another stand-up individual, by the way, a very honest person.
No reason to doubt them.
No, right? Absolutely none. Her assessment is that that smaller object in her bedroom was probably a non-human, an alien device. That's her opinion. But that the later object is one of our attempts to copy what they have. I don't see that as illogical at all. I see that as entirely possible. But my point is that simply in an era of modern drones, we have drones now that have lasers mounted to them to shoot down missiles. We have drones that can go at thousands of miles per hour, officially speaking. We have drones that have what are called sense and avoid systems on board to enable them to not collide with other aircraft in the sky. They're becoming incredibly sophisticated. And on top of that, you know, aside from the video effects that people can create to create hoaxes, in the cases of legitimate sightings that are out there, there's one that I just saw from earlier this month in November of a UFO or apparent UFO over a Mexican nuclear facility. And this is a very interesting video, and I don't think this is fake, but the question is, what is it?
And they shut them down, don't they, for a while?
Yeah, there have been cases, a number of cases, where nuclear facilities, nuclear technology have been disabled, have been shut down. Absolutely, yes. And we only know about a few of these, because I really think most remain secret, George. I think of, like, if you know, when you think of the amount of UFO activity that's out there every single day, every day. In North America alone, the two main websites that collect reports, the National UFO Reporting Center and the MUFON database, they combine for well over 10,000 sightings a year. Well over 10,000 sightings a year, just in North America alone. And so I'm not saying those are all alien craft, obviously, but some of these are real head-scratchers, very difficult. So if you pretend that, like, there's this wall and every UFO sighting is a white dot, well, you know, after a little while, that wall would be completely white. But then here comes secrecy with buckets of black paint, and they tossed buckets of black paint on the wall, and all we have left are these little white spots. That's the data that we have to work with. That's what I'm convinced. And in terms of the nuclear UFO connection, I'm convinced all that we get to look at are those little white spots that are not covered up by the black paint, because most of that stuff is covered up. I think that this is a significant thing happening. But again, it's more and more tricky these days, because our own official capabilities are just so advanced. I think, you know, there's this spectrum of officially acknowledged technology, then classified Defense Department technology, And then I suspect that there's technology that's in the black budget world that's even beyond that in what I call a breakaway civilization that may not even be under formal DOD control, for all I know. So you've got this spectrum of advanced technology. But even I think what the Pentagon has is, you know, what we're learning. I went to Boeing's website a little earlier, and their unmanned airborne systems, in other words, their drones, they've got a lot of very, very advanced technology that's out there. And it just makes it more and more difficult for a UFO researcher who's trying to differentiate between, you know, what are we making and what might we not be making.
Right.
It's harder and harder and harder.
What do you think of the alien, as Paula Harris says, contact program as opposed to the abduction program, which is all one and the same to me?
Well, I know Paula, and I assume by that she means...
She thinks they're happening for good purposes.
Yeah, well...
I'm not so sure.
No, I don't know. I think what's happening is that if I try to be as objective as I can, and this is hard because this is such a confusing subject, but it seems to me that we're dealing with multiple groups. And I only say that because this almost sounds like a cop-out. Well, because there's all of these different experiences people have. But when you really think of the different experiences people have, it does seem like there are multiple types of groups. You have entities that look totally different from each other. They could, in theory, be working together, but are all the humans really working with all the reptilians and all the grays? Are they actually all on one team? It doesn't seem right to me on that basis. And on the other side of it, there's also, you do have people who have what they are adamant about are these very positive contacts, often with human-looking beings. You got the strange friendship case from over in Italy from years and years ago from individuals who seem very credible, frankly, when you listen to them speak about their encounters with a very, very tall human or very, very short human who gave them all of this information about their, their civilization. These people don't seem to be lying. Is it possible that there's a contact agenda? I guess I would say the answer is yes, it is certainly possible that there's a contact agenda from some of these creatures. But I, like you, I have a bit of caution before I would really endorse that thesis. On the other hand, I do feel comfortable saying that there is a covert operation going on, that there are beings that do not look human, that look like what we call the grays,
right,
short with large heads and black eyes. And this is something that comes through so many times, and this is not simply cultural programming.
And those, of course, were the beings that people from the Roswell era reported.
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, I had a conversation with a retired U.S. military officer, high level, who had a longstanding interest in UFOs, who told me point blank of his meeting with in the classified world of a man on his deathbed, who had been at Roswell in 1947, and this officer was able to interview this man, accompanied by military security, who were in the hospital room with him, and he had a conversation with this guy about being there. The man described the being, which was short, not like a classic gray either, but short, definitely not a human being like we are. An interesting aspect of that, I guess I'll just mention, is that the colonel, this guy was a colonel, and he said to the dying man, he says, it's a shame that you can't talk about your incredible experiences. Wouldn't it be nice if there were a presidential executive order that would liberate you from your secrecy oath? And the man said, exact quotes, George, it would take a hell of a lot more than a presidential executive order to liberate me from my security oath.
So true.
And I asked, well, what are we talking about, something beyond the president? He said, yeah, that's what I would assume. Something beyond the president, something more powerful than the president. Fascinating world. But in terms of the contact issue, my guess is this, that we humans right now we're at a very fascinating moment in our history.
For Michael Cosio, Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.